You marry them, they start doing their sound for you. Mm-hmm. It's great.
Sound is speeding.
Cool.
And we're rolling.
Awesome. Hey guys, this is Virginia with Super Hungry, the podcast, and I am here with the Mads themselves, Trace Beaulieu and Frank Conniff, and I'm really excited. We've been talking about bees already. Who knows where the day is going to go? So thank you guys for being here.
This Thank you.
Only the best for you. We've got you in the back loading dock of the convention hall here. You know, just wanted
great
to keep
to
it
be
classy.
Here.
Yeah. I saw your Q&A, so I wanted to keep it for par.
Johnny Friendly says we work today.
Yes. This is a gorgeous theater, and Hall of Heroes has been nothing but gracious and friendly and so giving and helpful.
And great for a first-year con.
Yeah,
really organized
great.
And
they
super nice.
They have their stuff together, and the staff is great, and the theater is gorgeous.
You guys met Alan?
We had a great show there last night.
Yeah. I'm so bummed that I missed it. I was in Michigan. But what movie did you guys end up riffing?
It's called Walk the Dark Street.
And I heard in there that not a lot of people had seen
no
it
No one has ever seen it.
And where did you find it?
Searching the internet, looking for film noir. Mm-hmm. And this has a very distinguished pedigree in that it's written, directed by the same guy that brought us Robot Monster.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's
another
where the bar.
Another noir classic, right.
Yeah, exactly.
So what is it, do you guys, and I'm sure you get asked a version of this a lot, but what is it that you think about movies in general as a format that's timeless enough to keep sort of doing the riffing? Because you guys are touring with The Mads Are Back.
Right.
You've also got, you know, Movie Sign with The Mads, your podcast where you're riffing on newer films. It's a format that, you know, you guys are really pioneers of. What do you think makes it so fun to keep doing?
Well, to me, the essential ingredient for any movie that you're going to do a riff of is sincerity on the part of the filmmakers. It's filmmakers who sincerely were trying to make what they thought would be a good film, and then for whatever reason, it doesn't work out. And then the riffs are just kind of, we're taking the hard work that the filmmaker put in, and then we're adding riffs to it to kind of, we're kind of collaborating with them on creating a whole third form of entertainment. So
the third heat, if you will.
Yeah, so filmmakers who are like self-aware and who are kind of winking at the audience, you know, like the Sharknado kind of film.
Right.
That's not kind of what we think is the best kind of film to riff.
So I imagine you guys get like pitches for movies a lot.
Constantly.
All the time.
Constantly.
Yeah, I was at an event recently and a nice older man came up, but he was holding like a bound script book, like he had spent some time on this, and as he started to really get into it, I found out very quickly that it was called Tomato Nado, and it was a play on Sharknado with hybrid tomatoes.
Oh, cool.
I'm surprised you didn't see where that was going.
I think I've seen like a graphic for that. These angry tomatoes with teeth.
He then really proceeded to ask us how to make it, and I was like, I don't know.
This is the same guy that made Ketchup, the movie.
Yeah, he's also...
Also, Tomato Nado sounds like a European organization to help protect the allies from tomatoes or something. I don't know.
Donald Trump has already withdrawn his support for Tomato Nado. We just need only non-organic. We need the farmers. Yeah. Well, you guys are in the middle of your tour. You guys are here, obviously, as part of the Mads Are Back tour. You mentioned on stage that you do a lot of stuff with the Alamo Draft House.
And yes.
So is there anything in particular that is conducive to that kind of venue? Because for people who haven't been to the Alamo Draft House, you guys mentioned it on stage, but they're really kind of sticklers for the art of movies.
Right.
And that's kind of...
And yet they allow us into
their plans. Yeah, I was going to say counterintuitive to some of what you guys do.
Everyone at the Alamo is steeped in film.
Yeah.
You know, everyone who works there, the staff, the owners, obviously. And it's they've also trained their audiences to watch film and be thoughtful about it. So we deal in riffing on the language of movies, it's perfect for us to go to those venues.
Yeah, and one thing I learned from the last time we were at the Austin Alamo Draft House, which was the original one, and they're very steeped in film culture there, and But bad movies, and maybe because of the Mystery Science Theater influence, bad movies are very much a part of film culture.
Right.
It's very much a part of what people, film geeks, if you will, people who are really into films, a lot of them are, of course, they're into classic great movies, and they're also into bad movies, too. Yeah. And that's a really interesting thing to observe, which I think Mystery Science Theater had something to do with that.
Oh,
yeah, we were
absolutely
introduced to films there that we had never seen.
Yeah, because they had a whole, at Master Pancake Theater, who's a troupe that we riff on films with there, they have a thing where audience members suggest films, and then the audience votes on it.
Well, they bring the films.
Yeah,
they have the DVD film night and a VHS. And the audience brings a VHS, and everyone decides which one.
Like
you have to make a pitch.
Night, basically.
Like if you brought Rubber, the Terror Tire, you'd have to make a pitch to the audience.
Or the forthcoming
Tomato-Nato.
Tomato-Nato.
I would say Potato-Nato would be a good one, too.
The sequel, Potato-Nato.
They just change a few letters. And it's so much fun. We did a film with them called Never Too Young to Die,
which we had never heard of. It stars John Stamos and Gene Simmons from Kiss is the transvestite villain in it. George Lazenby is in it. Vanity. It was an amazingly fun movie.
It sounds great.
Yeah, and I'd never heard of it before. And we did an improvised riff of it, and it was really fun.
Well, I mean, definitely know that that's an influence that you guys in the show had a huge hand in, because when I was in college, I went to Florida State University, currently made famous because Barry Jenkins, the director of Moonlight, also went to Florida State University. Like 7 crew members were on that film. But we have an on-campus movie theater. And so my freshman year, good friend of mine, Bonnie, who is, I'm sure you've met her a few times at one of the cons at something, but basically it was a vote for midnight movies because we would always play these midnight films, and it got to the point where she had campaigned, I want to say, solidly for about 3 months, so almost a full semester of just campaigning, and then at the end of the semester we ended out with Mystery Science Theater 3000 the movie, and it was really exciting.
Cool.
Because
cool.
But in that genre, she was so hard to push for it because she was like, this is why we do midnight movies. She's like, you guys have to understand that this is part of why this even exists.
Right.
Because we would show things, you know, like old spaghetti westerns or, kind of old foreign film, anything that sort of could lend itself to a smaller audience that is interested in why they'd be there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that is a huge part. But you see it, you even mentioned now, there's so many different, I think, troops that have started taking on movie riffing that
there's a lot in New York where I live. I get together with other comedians sometimes, and next week St. Patrick's Day at this club, the QED, we're going to do Leprechaun.
Fun.
Yes,
that's the original Jennifer Aniston, right?
I'm not sure. I haven't seen it yet, so.
Well, spoiler alert, I think Jennifer Aniston is in it. But I'm not sure. She's in the first Leprechaun.
I think so. I've never seen it before.
Spoiler alert, I guess, I'm ruining this for everybody. But so other than, you know, you've got the tour, you've got the podcast, I know that you came out with a book last year. It was the 25 movies.
25 Mystery Science Theater films that changed my life in no way whatsoever, which is just a collection of silly essays that I wrote about. I just took 25 films and basically used them as a jumping off point to let my stream of consciousness go and kind of make connections in my head between things that didn't necessarily need to be made. And there's a section in each chapter called the Obscure Reference Task Force, where I'm berated for indulging in obscure references. So it's a very silly book, but a lot of people, I've gotten a lot of great feedback on it. People seem to really be enjoying it.
Were you the one that was writing more of the obscure references when you were on the show? Because there
were but you know, everyone was, though. You know, we had a very common frame of reference on the show. We all kind of grew up, myself, Trace, Kevin Murphy, like we were all huge Frank Zappa fans, you know, living in different parts of the country, but all like listening to the same music, watching a lot of the same television shows. So I definitely had my fair share of obscure references that made it into the show, but I think everybody contributed to that.
We all came in with a lot of arcane knowledge.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was no way to record things when we were growing up. There was no internet to do research on. So we had to remember stuff. And it was a more...
know things.
What's that?
You just had to, like, know things.
Yeah, you just had to know stuff. Yeah. You had to read books and see movies and listen to albums. And we brought all of that with us into Mystery Science.
You know, were there any... Because I've met you guys before. I've gotten to ask you a few questions before. And one of the questions I had asked you previously was, what was one of your favorite sketches that you guys did? And in reference to the obscure references, one of my favorites was actually... it was in The Sword and the Dragon, and it was the Ingmar Bergman black and white sketch you guys did about running out of the boards. And like, it was a very weird in-between sort of sketch. You had mentioned previously that you really liked the Rat Pack chess set.
The Rat Pack chess set,
Is that still kind of one of your favorites? Or
and you know, some of the ones that are my favorites, sometimes, in the case of the Rat Pack chess set, it's not even... It's a favorite of mine, not even necessarily because I think it's one of the funniest things we do, but I kind of like how scholarly it is.
Yeah.
It's very,
it
really is accurate about the Rat Pack, and we go not just into the famous Rat Pack people, but the kind of people that were associated with them, like Sammy Kahn, the songwriter, and Tut Shore, the restaurateur, and the ultimate villain is Mitch Miller. The sketch ends with Mitch Miller, and that's like totally based on real life. Every Frank Sinatra and every one who worked with Mitch Miller in the 50s, who was probably the most successful record producer of the 50s, considered it the low point of their career because he was so... Sinatra did a record with Mitch Miller that was him and a TV personality, Dagmar, and called, I think, Mama Won't Bark with a barking dog in it. And Frank Sinatra literally considered that the low point of his career. And it was before he was in From Here to Eternity. It was like before he made his comeback and stuff. So I like, we did some sketches like that where I just took pride in the accuracy of the scholarship embedded in the sketch.
Yeah. That's fun. That must have been sort of an extra, like, side thing where you guys are making yourselves laugh in the room.
Yeah, well, the whole thing was we made ourselves laugh, and if we made ourselves laugh, it got into the show. And then we were just very fortunate that a lot of other people thought the stuff that we thought was funny, they thought was funny, too. And I really think that's the only way to make a comedy show is to do what you think is funny. If you try to... second guess the audience, that's where all the bad comedy comes from, when they're not expressing their comedic sensibility, they're expressing what they think the audience's comedic sensibility is.
So do you think that a lot of comedy has to do with confidence? Because I think that there's so many, you know, you and I were talking a bit before about alternative comedy and things like that, and I think that there are a lot of, you know, comedian, like up-and-coming comedians, or, you know, even very established comedians right now that don't really have a similar, like, hey, what's up, everyone, joke, you know, punchline format. Do you think that a huge part of comedy is just confidence of delivery?
Well, it requires a certain amount of confidence, but yet all comedians are the most insecure people I know.
Yes.
So it's, but one thing that I've observed of comedians now, they're really, you know, I live in New York where there's a lot of great young comedians and older comedians, but the thing I've noticed, like, since, like, when I came to LA, like, kind of at the height of the alternative comedy movement, and it was kind of very far over in the area of people just kind of being confessional and talking about their day and kind of purposely not doing jokes and material, but it was very personal. And I think what that's evolved into now is comedians who are being personal and are being very individualistic, but they're conscious that it's a craft, and they're crafting their personal things and their individualistic observations about things. They're crafting them into real comedy bits. It's not just someone reading out of a notepad anymore.
Right.
You know, so I think it's gone in a really good direction.
Do you have any current comedians that you're following, or like up and coming people that you're really into right now?
Oh, well, our Carolina Hidalgo, who's on our podcast, is really funny. And there's people in New York. Mike Kaplan is really funny. Micah Fox. I'm going to leave people out that...
That's all right. They'll just think you hate them.
Okay. You know, but there's a lot of really, really funny comics. And then there's the more established ones who are like my heroes, like Dana Gould and Greg Proops and Maria Bamford, who I've been a friend with for 30
Andy
years.
Andy Kindler is another
Andy
great.
Kindler.
I loved all the Andy Kindler jokes in Lady Dynamite. Did you guys watch
show? Yeah.
All the jokes about how Kindler was like, it was like number one, and then like you notice like in the age, he's got like a framed photo of Andy Kindler like on his bookshelf.
Yeah.
It's the perfect, I don't know
it's
why
hilarious.
That joke was so
yeah.
funny to me, but that was such a great show. Yeah. I love Maria. She's, I think her and Tig Notaro are probably two female
yeah,
comedians that I really
just love.
Yeah,
I've worked with Tig as
love.
Well, and they're both great. Yeah.
That ability, I think what you said, to take the personal and sort of turn it on its head into something mm-hmm. that is relatable, especially for Maria. Obviously Tig, you know, has had cancer, and that is something that so many people relate to, obviously.
Right.
But I think Maria's anxieties and sort of mental health, that is another similar level of bravery to sort of just
yeah,
continue
and
to
she's,
talk about
and that's,
it.
That's an example that is that's just who she was or is. It's a person always had to deal with these issues of mental illness and depression, and as a friend of hers, we've talked about stuff. We've commiserated on that for years with each other, and so she just naturally incorporated into her art, you know. And Maria is one of the few comedians that I would absolutely refer to as an artist.
She's brilliant. Yeah, I think the whole show, watching that. From start to finish, I thought it was such a well-crafted
brilliant.
Story.
I loved it.
You know what
yeah.
I mean? The way she did all the flashbacks and everything.
Yeah.
It was so good. And I've seen her in, you know, L.A. in like a tiny club with like 60 people for $5. I saw her one time with Chelsea Peretti and Neil Hamburger on the same show. And it was like one of the craziest things ever.
I know.
He's amazing too. Sorry, random. So you've got a new book coming out.
Yes, I do. It's... going to come out hopefully in about a month or so. It's called Cats v. Conniff.
Okay.
And it's I do a lot of posts on social media about my cats.
I'm a big fan of your Twitter.
Yes, and they've kind of have had a big part of my success on social media, so it's about them suing me for defamation of character because I belittle them quite a bit on Twitter, and they finally had enough of it. So the book is about the trial of when they
really
sued
funny.
Me.
I mean, of all animals to do it, cats would sue. They're the most vindictive.
Yes, absolutely.
So
that'll be coming out soon.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And are you guys, let's see, you're planning more dates for the tour, right?
Yep,
and
we are working all the way through June,
great.
Up to June. We have a show with Riff Tracks June 15th.
Oh, that's exciting.
It's going to be a Fathom event.
So that means that they are broadcasting it live.
Yes.
Yeah,
the
all over the country.
Well.
It'll be taped in Nashville. But,
oh, fun.
But it'll be seen all over the country.
And those happen all over, right? You guys just will go to different, like when you end up doing them. I know you've only done the two Riff Tracks,
yeah,
right?
The first one we did in Minneapolis. This one we're going to tape in Nashville.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the previous one was a Mystery Science Theater.
It was a reunion of sorts. Yeah, this one is not necessarily
reunion. Yeah, they're not calling it a reunion.
Yeah.
But I think the show we're in, Paul F. Tompkins is going to be in
it. I did see that, actually. He's so funny.
And other comedians to be announced, I believe.
Oh, TBD. Excellent. So my podcast is, like I said, it's called Super Hungry Conversations with Not-So-Starving Artists. And a lot of my listeners kind of really like to hear stories about, you know, how life as a working artist really is, basically, and sort of how maybe the ups and downs and how you've kind of gotten through them and maybe what advice you would give to them. So if there are any comedians listening to this right now, which I'm sure there will be, What advice would you give to them for just starting off, maybe now in a time that's completely different than, you know, the 80s when you guys were starting?
Right.
You know, it's a completely different ballgame now because people have cell phones pulled out at everybody's first set,
yeah.
You know, so the theory now is that it's a lot harder to develop into something right away because you almost have to be good right away.
That's the thing is even if that's what people think that you have to develop right away, if you're a comedian starting out, don't listen to that. Don't pay any attention to that. The people who feel that are wrong. Stuff you do might get on YouTube before you wanted to or something, and that's a drag. But if you're a comedian, it's just about writing every day and getting on stage every night. Every possible open mic or opportunity to get on stage, you just have to keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and it'll take a long time. It's a big investment. It's not people who think, and I'm sure this is true in any field, who think, oh, I'm going to get in, and if I don't make it in 2 years, then I'll drop out. Or, you know, that's like a stupid attitude. The attitude is, I'm passionate about comedy, and I think I might want to do this for the rest of my life. And then that's really what it is. It's just something that you keep doing and keep doing. It'll take time for you to get better, you know, but comedians who are talented, who really work on it, always improve. They don't back up is what I'm saying.
Yeah, they do not back up.
As a comedian. If you hear that noise, that means you're going backwards.
Going the wrong way.
Go forward as a comedian. And I think it's the same when I was starting out as it is now. It's just stage time.
Yeah. Do you think it's easier? Not easier. Do you think, I don't know, having been in LA and briefly done the comedy scene there, do you think it's easier in cities that aren't New York or LA or Chicago to maybe hone that craft to get the stage time?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, I started and Trey started, we did comedy in Minneapolis, and that was a really good way to start because no industry people are going to come see you. Mm-hmm. You're never, the issue of auditioning to get on a late night show isn't in the air, and that's good because you just need to develop and you kind of need to do it just kind of anonymously, you know, in front of audiences. And back then the whole thing was, you know, do comedy in Minneapolis, go on the road and get good, get better, and then when you feel you're ready, move to LA.
Right.
I don't know if that's the same thing now because I think with social media and everything is so compartmentalized now that you don't necessarily have to go to LA or New York, but I can tell you that New York is a great place for a comedian, aside from the fact that there's no way you'll be able to afford to live there. You'll have to live in an apartment with 9 other people, but it's great for comedians starting up because there's a ton of places to get up and do comedy. And that's in any city you're in if you're a comedian. If you're in whatever town, Elkhart, Indiana, if there's a lot of opportunities to get up on stage, then you're in the right place.
Right. Obviously, you guys, the new reboot and everything, and doing the reunion show and getting to do that with Jonah Ray and all of that. You know, Frank, you and I were talking a bit before off camera about how, you know, this is something that as a fandom is a bit different than other fandoms, you
right.
know, and you guys are, you know, veterans, you've done the convention circuit for a while too, so you see firsthand other fandoms. There's something very familial about Mystery Science Theater fans. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever seems too aggressive. Nobody ever seems to really, you know, want to invade your space or your privacy or sort of, you know, very aware of the fact that you guys are people who are continuing to make art and do things.
Right.
What do you think it is about the show in particular that has borne such loyal fans who genuinely seem to care about you guys as people and as artists, you know, because they're buying, you know, your books and mm-hmm. your book, and mm-hmm. they're continuing to see the tours and listening to the podcasts and listening to your XM, you know, radio show and mm-hmm. following you guys on social media and stuff. What is it about the show that you think is so special to people?
Well, you're part of a group, and the whole experience of watching MST was like you're watching it with friends. And I think that carries over even now with our fans. And you mentioned how loyal they are. And we don't really feel there's that much separation between what we do and what people do at home. We have gotten better at it because we've done it more. But people feel a connection like, oh, I can kind of do this.
Yeah.
And we're very approachable. I mean, you'll see it at cons. And even our live shows, we don't hang out in the green room before the show. We mingle with the fans. We like to, you know, go in and out of doors a lot, chasing
every
them around.
going through it.
But, you know, we like to break the ice with the audience too. And like last night, we sat in the middle of the audience and not on stage.
To do the rhythm.
So we were surrounded by
groupies.
Just families and kids and everybody, and it's much more fun that way. And people feel included in that family.
Yeah.
And there's a sci-fi element to MST that something about that. Sci-fi and fantasy really bonds people because there are a lot of diverse cultures and people that are represented in sci-fi and fantasy. And you look at our audience, and it's a very diverse section of the population and very welcoming.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a lot of racism or...
No, it's all...
There's not even a lot of I was here first.
It's like welcome.
You find a lot of fandoms. Yeah, they're like, my God, finally.
I don't think there's an elitism here.
No.
Well, sci-fi fandom has given people a sense of community who might have beforehand felt a little not fitting in with, and I think a lot of creative people kind of start out that way where they grow up in school or whatever and they don't quite feel like they fit in. They feel like a little bit like they're other from everyone else, and the sci-fi fandom, and a lot of those people tend to get into sci-fi or just popular culture in general.
It's a place to escape to.
Yeah,
it's
and then they come to places like this, and then they find a community of all the other misfits.
Yeah.
I think that's part of the power of it.
Yeah.
And it's really annoying when you see, there's a con in town, and then the local news will go, well, it's the gathering of the nerds.
Yeah.
And it's like there's still that section of, the society that still sees this as a lesser thing.
Yes.
And if you come to these events, you see how embracing everyone
so
is.
Welcoming.
And so many families come up to us. People who come with their wife and their kids.
That's cool.
And it's the opposite of weird sci-fi geeks. It's like these are like the most normal people I've ever met in my life.
They just happen to be dressed like a Wookiee.
Yes, exactly.
And I like that better. I'd rather have people walking around in cosplay.
I saw a Wookiee mid crosswalk hug like a Sailor Moon or something as I was pulling in, and I was like, this is the place.
Oh, in Atlanta at Dragon Con.
You guys mentioned that. I'm from Florida, so I've been to Dragon Con.
It's just like the coolest stuff, and we had a kid here yesterday, David, who had made his own Crow and Tom Servo, and he put so much love into this thing, and even went beyond the Crow that you see on the show. He'd made legs, and he made a little cart that he can roll Crow around on, and made a little base out of all these model parts, and that's what I love about the cosplay world, is that it's so creative. It's not like I didn't just go buy the costume.
Right.
I made my Stormtrooper costume. I made my Wookiee costume.
I actually have friends who, speaking of Star Wars, do the whole thing where they'll make like the foam masks and then sort of like cast it out and have like a whole Boba Fett outfit or something. And
That's the creativity is just amazing.
And that's awesome.
That's why I love doing these cons, is to see, especially the little kids. There was a girl today who had the best smile.
Yeah.
And it just made my day.
Was she dressed like a princess or something? Or?
No, she was just a kid.
Just a kid.
But
just so happy. Yeah.
And
excited to meet us. And
and the whole family was there.
Yeah, the whole family. That's what I mean. It's like I'm the neurotic who has problems with my social skills, not these people.
I know. We're the weirdos.
Yes, exactly.
So I lied. I have one last question, and it's actually other space related because somebody brought it up on stage too, and that was, honest to God, it was one of my favorite TV shows I think I've ever seen, just because I thought it was so well done, and Paul Feig is just such a genius, and I think that it was all the right elements basically came together for that show. The humor was on point. You obviously are playing a robot again.
Yes.
Something new and different for you. So you.
But I'm a billionaire. I'm not just a robot. I am. I've had my. I'm a billionaire who has had his consciousness
Your AI,
or implanted.
It's one of the best lines that they almost it's like almost treated as a throwaway, but when you're like, and my body was burned publicly as a, you know, display, or it was like a prototype
Like, it's like, well, I can't go back into the body.
Burned it in protest. Like, it was just
Paul. That's
God, so funny.
You know, it literally was, hey, do you want to play a robot again?
Yeah, for Paul, of course.
Yeah.
And so, basically, right now, where it's left is that there. I know there's a campaign sort of where online people are trying to save. I know there's a Tumblr that's like Save Other Space. So basically, we're just trying to find it another home.
Right? Yeah, and cool. produce more shows.
Cool.
And I think you can still see the first season.
You can watch it all on
somewhere.
Yahoo. I think.
On Yahoo.
And then also on. There is like a fan Tumblr. I don't know if you're aware of this, but it's
I didn't know that.
They've posted every episode as like an individual post, and then basically they're trying to get the Tumblr verse to get enough fandom to bring it to either like a Hulu or a Netflix or something like that. Because I think it would absolutely work for that format anywhere else.
Oh, absolutely.
So.
I hope they don't wait too long because this cast is so,
so
popular.
Yeah.
If you saw Deadpool, you saw. The captain of Other Space, he's the cabbie.
Yeah.
He's also in Ghostbusters.
Yes, and then Neil Casey is
Casey's the bad
the
guy
bad
in Ghostbusters.
Guy in Ghostbusters
Beth Ross is a ghost in the library who comes out.
Fun.
Our friend Dave Gruber Allen is the ghost in the railway.
That's awesome. That's so cool.
Our friend Steve Banos. That's why Paul is such a lovely guy. He keeps, employing friends.
Yeah. Well, we talked about that in our interview because you were in Freaks and Geeks and keeps bringing you back. And he has a loyalty for Mystery Science Theater too, which I think
he loves the show.
He's such a nerd for
it. I think Other Space with Frank playing some kind of alien would be very cool.
Hey,
Season two, from your lips. Yeah, that would be amazing. You could be like one of the, because they kind of left it that you guys are running away from another alien.
Mm-hmm.
You could be the alien that's chasing them. It would be perfect.
Hey, I'm available. You're watching? I'm here.
Hey, Paul. Well, thank you guys so much for your
time.
This was amazing.
Thanks,
Virginia.
It was fun.
I'm thrilled. I have one slightly annoying request, if you wouldn't mind looking in the camera and then maybe just saying your names and then you're listening to Super Hungry, the podcast.
Sure.
Awesome. In the industry, we call that a bumper.
Yes.
You've probably heard of it.
I would say they're listening to what?
Super Hungry,
Super
the
Hungry.
Podcast.
Super Hungry, the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Hi, I'm Trace Beaulieu.
And I'm Frank Conniff.
And you are watching Super Hungry, the podcast.
Keep
Are you
watching.
Super hungry?
I'm always super. We just had lunch and I'm super hungry.
We're all super hungry for Super Hungry, the podcast. Eat it!
Thank you.